Okay, welcome back to the Investigative Journal on this Tuesday, October 14th, 2014 day on our calendar. I'm your host, Greg Anthony. You're listening to FirstAmendmentRadio.com. This, again, is the Investigative Journal, and glad to have you on board. I want to go back again, and I've been going over meticulously two cases, and that is the Tupper Saucy case, where he was charged with IRS violations and convicted to, I think it was 2 years in jail, 18 months to 2 years in jail. And Tupper then went on the lam because there were four counts in his indictment, and three of the four he had defeated easily. The fourth, basically, was a made-up law that didn't even exist, if you believe that or not. And he was adamant that he had done nothing wrong, and he was being targeted for the writing of his book, The Miracle on Main Street, his research on the Martin Luther King murder, as well as a new book he wrote when he went on the lam called Rulers of Evil. What he found in that book was an astonishing information regarding, first, that his prosecutor was a Jesuit priest, and secondly, he began to unravel this big, huge ball of yarn that takes us back to Rome, and how Rome has controlled this country from the beginning of our formation in the Revolutionary War, and even prior to that, the big prize being America. And the information in Rulers of Evil was written while he was on the lam for 10 years. And it was incredible what he found out. And he then was finally found in Venice, California. And he then went into prison, spent, I think it was 18 months, was then released. His book was finished. And you can get a copy of that, Rulers of Evil, online free. It's a PDF. You got to read it. He died in 2008, and I had an opportunity to email him a few times, and we discussed a lot of this information, and it was just the tip of the iceberg, and he was hoping to do a lot more, and he said, boy, I hope somebody continues on this path, because there's so much more to unravel in that ball of yarn. And some of us have tried to do that. And that case we will get to, but when you go over the court records of that case, it is amazing. And that takes a lot of patience and time, because these IRS laws, I don't even know if they understand them when you read them, so how can you be convicted? I mean, there's so many of them. If they want to trump up a charge on you, boy, they can figure something out. And it's a no-no to talk about the things that they talk about on this we talk about on this show. The difference between Tupper was that he had a large audience. Okay. Now, then we also are looking meticulously. Well, also I'm doing a theater play on this, and you find it quite interesting. Now I'm going to switch the page and go back to Tony Alamo. Now, this case is even more interesting. Tupper, more or less, we were talking about he was very much into the Federal Reserve banking system and the secular activities of the Vatican. Now, Tony as well, but he had a Christian ministry, which was a Bible-believing Christian ministry, taking a page out of the past, I believe, when Bible believers really talked about the papacy's inquisitional techniques that they use to silence anyone that doesn't fall lockstep with Rome. And Tony did that for 40 years, and we've done, you know, and I've said the case is so interesting that you need to go into the meticulous look, the meticulous files, the legal documents, the things they charged him with, and how they came up with these charges, and how many years they were trying to put this guy away, and testimony from undercover agents that never got into the trial that he had been targeted, which I believe, since if you go over his case, you'll find that he was convicted on circumstantial evidence. A violation of the Mann Act, which is to, with the intent to transport minors across state lines for the purpose of having sex with the aiding and abetting of others. Now, You have to understand that his ministry took many trips on buses. They have ministries across, one in California, one in Arkansas, another state, and they go back and forth. And they travel a lot. So the Manak was a very ripe possibility for the prosecution here when they were targeting this man. For example, they'd already targeted him in the 90s, I believe. Yeah, he spent 4 years for IRS violations. And I haven't really even had time to look at those trumped-up charges. And he had basically said the same thing that Tupper Saucy said, that there were no violations, and they were looking to silence him. So, what I said was this would have a chilling effect on all Christian ministries. It sends out a message to pastors all over, don't talk about us on the pulpits, us being the Vatican, in a negative way, and have a large filing following. And if you do, look what happened to this man. Now, I had gone over and over the way this raid was taking place. Now, I talked to Tony prior to this in 2008, and even a year prior to this, he was aware that they were trying to frame him. And he had spoken to an FBI agent, undercover agent, who had left the FBI over this case and said, listen, they're trying to nail you on a number of different charges. They're going to try pornography. They're going to try anything possible. Now, what I said was a man like him who had holdings, I mean, the church was quite... had a lot of land holdings and things in the millions and millions of dollars, which are now being taken away by a civil case that's filed in Arkansas, where the ministry had a $532 million judgment against it, the largest in Arkansas history. So a man with this much to lose is not, in my estimation, and aware of this, is not going to take risks. I mean, think about it, just from a logical point of view, let's forget about the moral aspects of this. From a logical point of view, this is, he realizes what's going on, he's going to be extra careful. And I guess the prosecution kept moving and moving and moving, and I went over how they raided this place, and then took away... started to take into custody all these kids, not only at the Falk, Arkansas ministry, but also around the country. And the judge, after taking six of them when they raided, this was SWAT team raids. There was nothing on that ministry you needed to do that with. Tony wasn't even there. He was arrested in L.A. And the intent was to blow this thing out of proportion and to alert 150 media outlets. And this thing was all over the news. It struck a chord that, there's something here that's going on. We got to figure it out. Now, I told you a long time ago, and you know my background, I went to law school. So I find a case like this quite interesting. And from looking at it from just a strictly a legal point of view, and I by no means am a competent or experienced defense attorney, but looking at all the facts that I've gotten over the years, you know something? With the proper time, when you take a case on, and I've worked in defense offices, you get a kind of a feeling, how good is this case? What am I dealing with here? Do I have a chance to win it? Is this man innocent? And when you compile all this evidence, I would go slam dunk 99.9, we can get this guy is being railroaded. He's not guilty of these charges. And we can show that if we have the proper time to prepare. Because this is a difficult case. Because, in a sense, the government had been looking and asking and hounding people. And they couldn't find anything on them. So they finally found four or five girls that they thought they could work with, thought they could coerce, I believe. And this, I'm looking at it from a defense attorney's point of view, because behind the scenes, folks, don't be naive, this goes on. And the prosecution, with its powers, has a, this isn't the first guy railroaded, folks, with evidence that's been tainted, that evidence has been manufactured, that witnesses have lied and coerced with the idea that they're going to get money in the future. And when you look at what we went over in this case and other shows, and I'm going to go over it again, the background information about how these girls were found, how they were taken to a, let's just call it a retreat, it's called the wellness center where, and I went over this specifically, where they were, you know, held and basically, in a sense, induced into testifying like this, coerced and even coached by the government, promised things, given things. Who knows what went on? That's just what we found out. Can you imagine what hasn't been found out? Now, that alone, to me, would strike a chord with the jury. It also would strike a chord with the jury that this man had, that the testimony of a number of witnesses, maybe 14 or 15 that weren't even allowed to testify, did not get contacted by the defense attorney, who was fired for, well, he left or fired or whatever. He was paid $350,000, and it turns out he didn't do very much. Remember I mentioned that? He went on vacation. The trial was coming up. A man's life is at stake. And this guy is absolutely doing nothing, not interviewing any of these people. Names were given to him that would help Tony's case. And if you put all that circumstantial evidence together, along with an FBI agent who was going to testify, which along, you know, on Tony's behalf about how the government had come to him, he would give names of his higher ups that were telling him what to do, and they could have been subpoenaed, but none of this was done. And you add that on top of what, you know, the girls, and then you add the witnesses that were there when the counts get right to the nitty gritty of what specific counts were charged against him. That's what I'm going to go over today in the court documents. So you're going to see that if you were just looking at this from a legal point of view, you had no interest whatsoever on either side, you would say, boy, this is a close call here. And if he was given a fair trial and he was given, and his attorneys were, that, look, one of the elements in this case, on this motion for a retrial, and to quash this conviction, is that he wasn't, there were no, there was not adequate preparation given to, for his trial, and it was a rush to judgment. And the man then was convicted on these close calls. It's kind of like, you know, when you think of an analogy on a baseball replay where, God, it's a tie, or it looks like he's safe, or, and they call him out. I mean, come on. You say, come on, what's going on? I mean, that's just an out in baseball. But when you got a 175-year sentence on you, a man's life at stake, and all these facts are adding up, I can't understand why he can't get a retrial now even. It's been sitting on the judge. This document I'm reading from has been sitting on the judge's desk for 2 years. And what I wanted to do was to get into the specifics in the court case, because what I want to do is, after I get into the specifics, which do not get into a lot of the background information that I've gotten, that attorneys should have gotten at trial regarding how this case went down, how these witnesses were taken into private quarters and coached by the prosecution. They didn't come. This wasn't like, you know, they've been trying for 40 years to get this guy. And when you look at the evidence they got, unless he did, and if he had, and you know, with the money he spent on this. And then to not get even these people called, and I showed you all the affidavits that were sent in on the witnesses that were never contacted by the defense, and one that was contacted, the FBI agent, who had damaging testimony to the government, which could have weighed the scales of justice in Tony's favor. He was promised to be testified, but the defense attorney never contacted him. And I said, what happened between that time? Did the prosecution get to him? Was he working on their team? Who the hell knows? But it looks that way to me. Now, I told you that we're talking about this Mr. Davis who was fired because he wasn't doing anything after being paid his money. And after new attorneys were hired, they failed to seek a trial continuance based on Mr. Davis's departure and the resulting lack of preparedness to bring the case to trial. And this is in the new attorney now writing this document. And he's saying, listen, how can you, you know, allow this to go on when these, you know, just strictly, I mean, malpractice all over the case, perhaps. I mean, they, you know, to prove that is difficult. But, man, you got to, if you're taking over this case from Davis, who didn't do diddly squat, you know, you got to say, listen, Joe, I don't have time. I mean, this is the man's life is at stake here. We got four or five witnesses. There's a lot of people that we need to contact. This is going to take a little bit more time. But no, he was rushed to trial. And in 10 days, this guy was convicted to 175 years. Now, let's look at some of the evidence at trial. And remember, I'm going to go back and then give you the background information about some of these four girls that the government either, coerced, and what the background information is on them, and then some of the things that went on prior to this trial that were so irregular that there should have been, you know, some judge should have stepped in and said, hey, listen, you know, no coercion of witnesses. Okay. Now, Mr. Hoffman, now the evidence, and when you say Hoffman, that was Tony Lama's name that he was born with, so I'll just refer to him as Tony, was tried and convicted on 9 counts of transportation of a minor with intent to engage in criminal sexual activity, aided and abetted by others. And you'll find that in 18 U.S.C. 2423. There's another count in there, and there's 10 together, and another one's in the same under the same Mann Act, but a little different. There's another subsection. But his attorney now stated that the evidence, which was adduced at trial, that went to the elements of each of these counts of conviction, as well as the evidence presented by the defense, which served to rebut the essential elements of the crimes charged, there was such a close call here. I'm saying this that I believe with a little more time and the proper defense that it would have been not easy, but I would have been confident that that no jury could have convicted this man. But when they get only part of the story, it's pretty easy to do that. Now, the attorney actually in this document, it's interesting, the factual calls on each of the 10 counts were close ones. Because and think about it, they were close with even a lousy defense. Can you imagine with a good defense? And I think there was something going on in the beginning of this case that needs to be looked at by any judge. That unless, you know, they got marching orders that this guy's got to go away. And that goes on. You know, they got to protect their jobs. And I told you a long time ago, the most endangered species in this country is an honest judge. Now, the factual calls, like he said, were close ones because the convictions turned on gleaning Mr. Hoffman's dominant purposes, in quotes, that's the statute, for transporting individuals who were part of his household. Sometimes traveling in response to their own requests or back to their parents' residence from circumstantial evidence. Now, ask yourself a question here. Why did they use the Mann Act? Well, there's a lot of little things here. You know, if you got close calls on intent, if you got a lot, just transporting, and then you can get all this circumstantial evidence in, and juries can be kind of tricky, you know. It isn't like a strict rape charge here. You know, there's a question here of transportation, if he crosses these lines, and the jury hears, well, he's got young girls, there's got to be something going on. So the Mann Act is a pretty flimsy act to begin with the prosecution, which, if I was a defense attorney, I would say, now, this is giving me a very good a very good indication that they have a weak case. Otherwise, they would have came up with a straight rape charge, right? Or other straight charges without using this intent to transport across state lines. It tells me as a defense lawyer, this is a weak case. But we got to rebut it because the prosecution chose to prosecute him. So what do? We mount a strenuous defense. We uncover every rock, under every rock, under everything. We bring this up and we fight hard to get all of this into this trial to show that there was no intent here and these crimes weren't even committed. But when you have a terrible defense and you leave a lot of strings untied, my God, the jury in their mind is thinking the worst, you know? And so the government knows that. And the factual calls on each of these 10 counts is said in this document, trying to get a quash, a quashing of this trial and a conviction, rests on a lot of legal terms, dominant purposes for the transporting of individuals who are part of his household, sometimes traveling in response to their own requests. So what the defense is saying, listen, a lot of these people, they were traveling because they wanted to. It wasn't as if he was forcing them on the bus to travel across state lines, was it? No. What he's saying is that they were traveling on their own requests. Sometimes to visit their parents, with their parents' permission. In addition, each count required a jury finding that the defendant was aided and abetted by others. Which, in cases like this, that's what these other people might have testified to that maybe never got called. Who knows? But geez, defense, you take $350,000 and you leave the guy hanging? Yeah. Instruction number 9 in this, they're given jury instructions, you know. And I'm telling you, I wish they would think about a way to do it that was, juries could understand them. I mean, the judge, some of the way they word these things, you know, I'm not saying this one was, but man, I've listened to jury instructions and I'm going, what? Shit, the guy's going to say, excuse my English, what the hell is that? I don't know. And then a lot of people are, you know, embarrassed to say, I don't understand that. But make them simple. Instruction number 9 instructed that a person who has no knowledge that a crime is being committed or about to be committed, but who happens to act in a way which advances some offense, does not thereby become an aider or abettor. Now, you know, I need that translated if I'm a juror. You know, and we're dealing with aiding and abetting, and there's a whole bunch of things that, you know, a jury can get confused about. But apparently, man, this thing only lasted 10 days, so they probably just threw up their hands and said, the government's got to be right. You know? Look at this guy. I mean, they didn't even paint a good, you know, when you get a lousy defense and you paint a bad picture, you're going to get a bad result. Even if a guy's innocent. Well, listen, I'm going to come back and finish up on some of these. Like I said, this takes a little bit of time. Bear with me. And it'll all be worth it in the end because it's unfortunate he has to get a trial on a radio show, isn't it? We'll be back in 3 minutes on the Investigative Journal.
Hear it first on FirstAmendmentRadio.com and FirstAmendmentRadio.net.
I know you all want answers, and believe me, so do I, and I'll do my best to get them.
Have you seen the Left Behind movies? Have you read the Left Behind fictional book series? Not everyone believes Left Behind is true prophecy. Some may even regard as conspiratorial the mainstream re-release of the Left Behind movie with actor Nicolas Cage portraying the main character as an attempt to further reinforce in the minds of all this perception of false prophecy in order to condition the masses for the play about to begin. Because they see the world stage shaping to fulfill what they have been led to believe is sound biblical interpretation, a left behind rapture scenario, this false view of prophecy is reinforced in the mind, not only of its adherents, but also includes those who have been merely exposed to the specific media. Is it possible that false prophecy can be fulfilled? The rapture theories have always been in dispute. Pre-trib, mid-trib, and post-trib disputes have risen up in exclusively evangelical circles of recent history. So that when true believers don't suddenly disappear, this element will easily go by the wayside when all see a new Jewish temple begin to be built. Will this be part of the great delusion that will come upon the whole earth? It seems that this great prophetic delusion has already overcome practically the entire American evangelical and Christian world. Get the book, The Rapture Will Be Canceled. To learn more, visit crosstheborder.org. That's C-R-O-S-S, crosstheborder.org.
Since the beginning of time, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it, it has been traded, it has been borrowed, it has been purchased, it has been stolen, there's a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty, to ourselves and to our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188 or visit discountgoldandsilvertrading.net. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cedarstrom, right here on FirstAmendmentRadio.com at 4 p.m. Eastern or 1 p.m. Pacific Time. Visit discountgoldandsilvertrading.net or call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. Toll free, 1-800-375-4188.
Okay, we're back for the second half hour of the Investigative Journal on this Tuesday. What is it? October 14th, 2014. Yeah, that's what it is. My, how time flies, doesn't it? I mean, I can just remember saying it was January, and then it was January of 2010, and 9, and 8, and 7, all the way down to, you know, where. But boy, it goes by quickly, and so does the hour sometimes. When you're discussing a travesty of justice like this, that just doesn't add up. And it's all forgotten, and we go on to another one, then there's another travesty of justice, and there's so many in those law books that I'm telling you, if every innocent man's case in a law book weighed 100 pounds, it would bring down any law library in the country really quickly, and they'd all just collapse like an earthquake. And boy, there's so many of them throughout the years. And we settle for less than what we deserve. And we could have a better system. But it's only as good as the people in it. And they know that. And if you ever see how you get to be a lawyer, it's insane. Most of the people that become one, let me tell you this. They're not representative of what a justice system should be all about. They're representative of good people who want to make a lot of money. Oh, of course. but it's not what it's all about, is it? Well, maybe it is today. Let's not be naive, right? Let's not be naive. But let's look at this case. So, like we said, all these factual calls were into this quagmire of the Mann Act. But there was very little testimony, says his new lawyer, indicating that the individuals who drove the young women were aware that a crime was being committed. So, or was about to be committed. And any such finding must have rested on purely circumstantial evidence. Wow. Doesn't that make you a little bit nervous? You know, just think of yourself. And if they want to get you, boy, you got little prayer to get out of it, I think, man. But anyway, count one and two. We're going to look at these counts specifically and then go back and look at some of the information. This is in another show we'll do regarding these 10 counts and these four or five girls that were found by the government and taken into private quarters for weeks, sometimes a month, or maybe even longer, and coerced, promised gifts and things like that, which we've found out. None of this was ever brought up in the trial. But anyway, count one. Well, you're going to use names of Jane Doe. Number one, Jane Doe 1. Count one was based on a trip from Arkansas to California between September and December of 2004, where Jane Doe, under the age of 18 at the time, traveled to California with Mr. Alamo and others on church business. She testified that he had sexual intercourse in a bus bedroom while the bus was on the road with 10 or 12 people nearby. In addition, she testified that only one thing he used me for was sex while I was there. Did not state whether she did not state whether it was her or the defendant's idea for her to go to California. She testified that she returned to Arkansas from this trip with Okay. Now, under cross-examination about count one, she testified to the defendant's own purposes for travel, which were both religious and personal, and included the recording and distribution of sermons and message tapes, attending to his congregation in California, and attending scheduler's doctor's visits. Defense testimony further established that the defendant did not request Jane Doe to accompany him on the trip, and that it was never planned for her to go, but that she and another individual asked to go on the trip at the last minute. Defense testimony from the other girl indicated that the travel in count one was incidental and not a dominant purpose of the trip, as the charged trip was planned and going to occur with or without her, and with or without Jane Doe. Such testimony established that Jane Doe asked to go on the trip, indicating that the defendant did not direct her travel nor bring her for sexual purposes. As a result, the facts in this count as far as purpose of travel, a necessary element of the offense, were, if at anything, close call and probably should have been ruled in favor of the defense. Similarly, defense testimony refuted Jane Doe's assertion that the defendant had sex with her on the bus trip. Multiple witnesses testified that the air conditioning on the bus was not functioning on that trip, and that any sexual activity in the bus on that trip would have been observed by witnesses and was not observed. These facts indicate a close credibility, a very, very tenuous credibility on Jane Doe's assertion of a fact that was highly determinative to the question of the dominant purpose of the trip. So, what needed to be done was a better defense in that case. More witnesses testifying on behalf of him in that. Who was on that bus? I mean, there's got to be a way to, you know, this is not some hideaway in the mountain. This is a bus trip with a whole bunch of people on the bus. And we've got some testimony here that they didn't see nothing occurred. Now, on count two, involved a trip where Jane Doe traveled from Colorado to California, staying in California from August to October of 2005. She stated that she moved to California to meet the movement at his direction. Her testimony was unclear as to whether she had sexual relations in California, but indicated that she returned to Arkansas from California and that the movement resumed sexual contact. Now, the point is, the charge, she was unclear whether there was any sex going on in from California to Colorado. And then we have very little rebuttal. I mean, we have very little on the defense's behalf as far as, you know, a he said, she said case. Boy, that can be quite interesting, can't it? Ask Kobe Bryant. But anyway, so that we get count two, another very, very, with even a terrible defense, a very close call. And we have a whole bunch of counts. We got 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, and you'll find some of the similarities in these, and the first one, and you'll find some of them even weaker than the one prior to it. But I'm going to get into those at another time. And I find on a radio show that I have to do it this way because there is very little. I mean, it's very difficult when we don't have any eye contact or anything to get the most out of this in one shot, is what I'm getting at, and overdoing it, because we tend to then gloss over things. And I want to make sure that this at least gets out in a fair way so people can think about it. Now, like I said, it's not, you know, I want you to look at this from both points of view and make up your own mind and understand what happened here. And I'm not trying to sway your judgment in any way whatsoever, but when I saw all the government hanky-panky going on here and all the government and the media outcry here, I started to wonder. I said, man, what really is going on behind the scenes? And does anybody really care? Does anybody really want to get to the bottom of this? And I think it's an important case to show that it can happen to anybody that comes against Rome's authority. And that is very dangerous to a free country. And I hope that you take it seriously. So we'll get back to that. And I also, after I get through these 9 or 10 counts, want to go back and show you what the government did to get the testimony out of these witnesses. It wasn't as if they just said, oh, come to court and tell us your story. No. They were coached. In many cases, they were offered things, given things, and who knows what went on behind the scenes. Well, when that starts, boy, you can get a lot of mix-ups. And I even had somebody tell me they were in trial watching a government official, sign language with one of the girls testifying against Tony. I mean, they were kind of like coaching her even right up to that point. So, you know, a lot of things. And when you put him in a jury in Fauk, Arkansas, when he asked for a change of venue because he didn't think he could get a fair trial there because they'd already passed an unconstitutional ordinance that was overturned. The city passed an ordinance. They didn't want him to put any of his literature on their cars. And that was ruled unconstitutional. So he had been getting a bad rap there for a long time. And in my contention, he could never get a fair trial there. But they didn't move it. And, you know, he might have got a better trial somewhere where no one, you know, was on, I guess it's supposed to be unbiased jurors. I doubt if you could find an unbiased juror in that location. So that's another point that I forgot to bring up that's interesting in this case. Where could you find an unbiased juror in Fauk, Arkansas? I think it'd be quite difficult, don't you? Well, listen, I'm going to get back to that story, as I always do, to refresh your memory. But some of the things, once in a while, it's really good to just, in a sense, put away all the literature, the research books, and put away all that, and just talk right from the heart regarding what we do on this show, and why we do it, and where it all came from, and how it's progressed, and how it hasn't progressed, you know, how it's taken sometimes two steps backwards, one step forward. And it isn't an easy task to talk about what I consider to be the one of the most hidden stories in the country's history, and that is the Vatican-Rome connection to our government and how instrumental it is in losing our rights and how instrumental it is in most everything that we talk about, including now ISIS, including Al-Qaeda, including going, you know, including 9/11 and moving all the way back throughout history. And many people who are unaware of this only because they grow up in a society that's been given, revisionist history has been given to them. I will say 90% of people will never, ever accept this kind of story, only because of their belief systems have been so ingrained. Now, when you're young and footloose and fancy free, you think you're going to live a whole, you're never going to, you know, think that you got thousands and thousands of years to waste. And so there's a lot of young people who really could give a damn. Older, and the older you get, the harder it is to teach a dog new tricks, right? And I'm just using that. I know that's not true, but as far as for dogs. But for people, I think it really, I think the older people get, the harder it is to teach them anything. And so, unless they got a really open mind, a real thirst to really find out what, they can't see the importance in this story. They only see what they want to see, and they see the importance is, oh, we've got to deal with these corrupt people. We've got to deal with, you know, things that seem solvable. But they're not, unless you understand that what's behind it. And how can you live like that in ignorance and blindness? But I find many people find it convenient, find it easier, and will turn you off very quickly when you talk this way. And when you start when you begin to bring in the spiritual and the government, and when you begin to tie in, oh, things going back to Babylon, things going back to the Bible, things, oh, wow, what does this have to do with where we live now? Well, you know, folks, that's the biggest mistake anybody will ever make. Because, you know, if you, how much time, and just ask yourself, because I've wasted an awful lot of time in my life, and I would have probably used a lot of my time wisely, I would have been a lot further ahead than I am now in this quest to figure this out, but I didn't, and most of us are the same way. But I really think that I then become in a minority because I decided not to waste it, and I use a lot of my time thinking about these things and knowing how important they are. But I know there's going to be a lot of people that don't, and I'm just saying to you right now, don't be a person that wastes your time. I mean, just think about all the time you're going to waste. You could spend 20 minutes, an hour, half hour a day researching this, building up your knowledge. You'll see the importance of it. You'll see how it'll change your life. You'll see that it may be difficult, but you're not going to leave this earth one of the ignorant and the blind. And I'm not saying blind, you know, really blind. I'm saying, you got eyes that can see, but when you closed them, you didn't know what the hell you were looking at, is what I'm saying. And I don't want you to leave that way, but unfortunately, most people will. And I'm, you know, they say you're your brother's keeper, but man, you can't, how many brothers can you keep when they don't want to pay attention? And not that what I do is any different than what other people do, but if you pay attention to other things in life, I mean, you listen to a lot of garbage in your life and you pay attention to it. Pay attention to this story because it isn't garbage. And it's probably one of the biggest stories that's never been told in the history of this country. And the reason it hasn't been told is because that's why they can get away with what they're doing to us today. And the more you learn about that, the more you'll understand two things. They want you, you're going to see that most of the people that are striving to get to the truth end up thinking, let's revolt. Let's form a group and change all this. That's exactly what the powers that be want you to do. Because in that case, you'll be going against God and country, and God help you. We know, if you study this, that that's not who they worship. This country is not you're not their biggest priority. Gaining the country for their self-serving purposes is. But they use God and country to protect what's going on illegally right before your eyes. And if you revolt and go against them, they'll use that. And thank God, thank God that I've learned that's not the way to go about it. Don't get inspired by it. Don't get frightened. Don't go into these kind of things. And we're going to revolt. That's exactly what they want you to do. And then people say, well, how are you going to change it? Well, you ain't going to change it that way. Unless it's a revolt that they start and they instigate. Then, you know something? You see a lot of those. But they do it for a reason, and they get unsuspecting people to revolt on the side that opposes them for a reason. It's kind of like getting the Muslims to fight against the Christians and the Christians to fight against the Muslims. Boy, in the end, you got this thesis, the antithesis, and then their synthesis of what basically they want the outcome is. And they know they can't get it without conflict. So don't fall into their trap. No conflict. No Hegelian dialectic. Simple as that. Most people don't know. So they say, let's revolt. And doing that, you've put one step into the mud. And pretty soon you're going to be in quicksand, and pretty soon your head is going to be below water, and that's going to be the end of you. Because that's exactly what they want. Because they'll use exactly the opposite. They'll use God and country against you. When basically, perhaps you're the person that really believes in his country and in God. That's how they operate. What's the other way? Many people, when they learn a little bit, they want to just get out of the... Let's leave. Let's hide ourselves away. And people ask me, where's the safest country to go in the world? And, you know, I don't think there is a safe country. But I do think there's places you can go. If you really don't want to deal with America, just go. There's other places. I mean, there's nothing... You can live in Norway and feel like a Norwegian. I mean, but is that what you want? And how many people can do that when they got family ties? And when they got ties to this country, it's not a way to go. And so some people say, well, I'm going to hide out in the Appalachian Mountains. I'm going to live off the grid. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that. And, you know, they like that also because, you know, if you're out of sight, you're out of mind. And they don't have to deal with you. And how, you know, is that fun? I mean, some people, I guess, like living like that. And that's fine. If you want to live in the woods, that's up to you. But if it's for the reason to get away from the New World Order, I don't think that's the reason to live in the woods. You may like it. I mean, I'm not saying it's not a good place to be. I probably find it quite rough. I'm not it's not my thing, but maybe the rabbits and everybody would enjoy the show a lot more. You don't know. That might be my calling. You know, go out there and talk to all the animals, and then they say, boy, he really went off the deep end. But you know, if you could speak their language, you'd be in a lot better shape. But what I'm getting at, a little aside there, in general, the escaping this is not going to be the answer. So what is the answer? And that's the, you know, $64,000 question, as they say. Is there may not be a good answer. Can you live with that? Oh, yeah, there's not a lot of answers, and everything doesn't have an answer. I can think of 100 different things that don't have answers, but we strive to get them. So maybe we're still looking for it. Or maybe it's just making yourself available to people so they can understand. And I contend that understanding is more important than a dollar bill. And I contend understanding is more important than revolt. More understanding is more important than hiding away. And by understanding, maybe we will find some solutions. And that's really the bottom line on this whole thing. What is your quest? What is your thirst for this information? What do you think? What do you think is important in life? What do you think will solve your problem? I mean, we got all kinds of problems we always deal with every day, and those are the ones that need to be solved. I mean, sure, you got to do things that are important to you every day, but in a sense, when will come the time when you will not have the ability to do that? When everything will be taken. And you're basically out in the cold going, how did this occur? Kind of like, you know, when you look back at Nazi Germany, there's a nice little, I close my eyes and I say, you know, I remember that many of these people were blindsided by Nazism. And in fact, many of them who were taken into, their lives changed overnight. They were out at an opera one evening, you know, dressed to the T, dressed to the nines, thinking they're going to go back to their shops and do business. And at the stroke of midnight, everything changed right before their very eyes. And they had plenty of information to figure out that this could have occurred, but they didn't. They didn't want to believe it. They said it could never happen. And, you know, that sounds like people here. And I hope I'm wrong, but you know, history has a strange way of repeating itself, doesn't it? And usually the people, the good people, are on the short end of the big stick. So look back, you know, I see that. I close my eyes and I see that vision of these, you know, very prosperous people in Germany and in Poland going to this opera and thinking they're going to see their children just like they always did, and thinking they're going to be able to have the food on the table just like they always did, and thinking they can run their businesses and see their families and watch their kids grow up just like they thought they would, change overnight without them knowing. Well, maybe with them knowing but not doing anything about it. That is what will be repeated, because the same circumstances that were going on then can be done all over again, but just in a little different manner, in a little different way. But the end result is the same. So beware of that. You know, use this information. You won't be one of those people. Now, I'm not saying, and you're thinking, well, would it change anything? Well, it might have. You never know. But anyway, we're all done, and we'll be back tomorrow, Wednesday, on the Investigative Journal. Good night.